Hello to my Zoomies. I'm supposed to be on Zoom today. This is my Zoom Sunday, but I don't know, I had to come into in-person church. Oh, well. I love in-person church. Anyway, as a wee lad going to Redeemer Episcopal Church in the 1950s, cutting my God teeth at the Redeemer Church, half of the country was at church on any given Sunday. I bet half of your friends are not at church today. And the denominations in the cat seat were the Lutherans, Presbyterians, but especially Episcopalians. Those were the power players, just like Catholics and Evangelicals today. White-collar workers, the Detroit area, GM, Ford, Chrysler. Oh, let's not forget American Motors, right? Blank looks from you people. It was really just good to be seen at church, and especially the Episcopal Church, known then as, my Episcopal priest wife told me, is known as the Republican Party at prayer. Can anyone name the last two Episcopal presidents? The last two of 10?
George W.
Bush and Gerald Ford, that's right. Who was the first? Another George. Washington, exactly. FDR, man, they were the dudes. In the 1950s, the Episcopalians, though, learned the hard way that too much power and privilege can hollow the heart out of your faith. And Episcopals know that today. I would say the sermons I heard at the Church of the Redeemer could put an insomniac to sleep. I would get lightheaded in church, in the pew. A few times I had to be taken out and administered smelling salts. That is God's truth. It might have been the sugar pops that I was engorging in the morning. Sugar cereal, what a great idea. In the 1950s, the Episcopalians really learned that lesson, and they know it now. At age 12, I took a six-week, I think it was called a confirmation class to prepare you for your first communion, the commandments, the creeds, how to receive communion the right way. One Sunday during the class, I was shocked to see my confirmation class teacher walking back from receiving communion, and she had tears in her eyes. And I was like, what is that? She's moved by something. Like, that was, I'd never seen that before, noticed it before at church. And I remember in the class one day she had asked, what is wrong? We were doing the Ten Commandments. What's wrong with murder and adultery and robbing and all that? And we were smart 12-year-olds. We said, well, it hurts people. And she says, well, who? And, well, the one who was murdered, the one who was cheated on, etc. She said, yes, but who else is hurt when we do those things? And we were stumped. But I had an idea. I put up my hand. She called on me. And I said, God is? And she said, looked at me, that's right, Kenny. It's like, you know, we shared a spiritual secret, like we knew something from the inside. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm something else, you know. At 12, I'm on the cusp between that kind of innocence and the cynicism, the yeast of cynicism that was in the air even in 1964 when I was 12. So when I knelt at the communion rail with my classmates for the first time to receive communion, the priest came to me with the wafer. Now, I knew that you're supposed to put your right hand over your left hand and let the priest put the wafer in the right hand for communion. I knew that. I never asked why that was. Now I would say the rule probably reflected bias against left-handedness, right? You know, in French, what left is what gauche, in Latin it's sinister. In English, the left hand is not the right hand. My grandpa Ben got his left-handedness ruler slapped out of him when he was growing up. Me and my sisters are all left-handed, so we're standing up for Grandpa Ben. At my first communion, though, I was really new to critical thinking. I did not distinguish between truth and cultural bias. I was left-handed, and I knew the rule, on impulse, instead of going like this, I went like this. And the priest flicked my left hand into compliance, flicked my hand into compliance with the body of Christ until I went like that. That began my 7-year sabbatical from communion and from church. I returned to communion in 1971. Today marks, AI did the math for me, marks my approximately 3,504th time receiving communion. Many of those, I'm not that old, many of those were like, I had 3 services or 2 services and I took it every time. Rituals have their effects on us through the magic of repetition, right? Brushing your teeth, celebrating birthdays. Rituals can form a pathway in the soul, in the body, like the footprints of deer form trails through a forest. Now, my generation, man, we disdained rituals. Rituals, especially in religion. But they do have the power to shape the inner landscape. And they can shape the inner landscape to what Emily mentioned is a sturdy, resilient, and convictional faith. And that's what we need these days. Judaism, of course, always had its ritual meals. Last Supper in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, not in John, took place during the Passover festival, when the opening day of Passover, when Jewish households would make, you know, pilgrimage to Jerusalem, to the temple. They would bring or buy a lamb, which would be sacrificed in the temple, and then the meat would be brought back to where the household was having a meal, and they'd have kind of a simple ritual meal. Now, Christians, I got to say this, you know me, I got to say this, Christians criticize temple sacrifice as primitive, but they were part of an ancient ethic embedded in ritual that limited the use of God's creatures for human consumption. Most temple offerings were not of meat, they were of oil, bread, or wine. In Leviticus, the only quadrupeds, I won't go on this long, but I got to say it, offered in the temple were available, only the ones you brought to the temple as a sacrifice were available to be eaten at the Israelite table. So that placed a severe limit on meat eating. So, you know, we moderns demonize the past so we don't have to face our own demons in the present, right? The full-blown Seder came later, but this was a precursor to it that was being observed, most likely. There's a ritual blessing of bread and of wine, accompanied by remarks from the host, some conversation, presumably. Matthew and Mark make a point to mention that the evening ended with a hymn sing. It was a remembrance, it was a reparticipation, it was a reenactment of the last meal of the Hebrews before their daring nighttime dash out of Egyptian bondage. You can see why the Romans were especially on high alert in Jerusalem during the Passover festival. Jesus and his disciples had come to Jerusalem. Jesus was wildly popular when he came to Jerusalem. And thus, he was even more of a threat to Rome. He and his disciples gathered in an upper room that had been arranged for them, while the streets below were like crawling with armed and uniformed 17 and 18-year-olds from around the empire, ready to put down uprisings and not using their fully formed frontal lobes for it either. The disciples, the mood, they're confused, they're terrified, most likely. Jesus, though, is dangerously determined and resolved, even though he's under threat of impending arrest. One of their own was actually back-channeling with the authorities. Now, we don't know why Judas was doing that. William Clausen, a Canadian Anabaptist scholar, peace-loving, wrote a book called Judas, a Betrayer, Friend, Betrayer or Friend of Jesus. And he challenges the portrayal of Judas in Christian tradition as the ultimate victim. It really got bad in the Middle Ages. The Greek word actually translated betray is simply delivered. It's a morally neutral term. In one gospel, Judas does so at the behest of Jesus. So 2,000 years later, we know the demonization of Judas, which means Jew, has served a very, very ugly purpose. So I'm not getting into that stuff. No, no, no. Here's the words of institution that we use in the communion meal. While they were eating, Jesus took a loaf of bread, and after blessing it, he broke it, and he gave it to the disciples and said, "Take, eat, this is my body." Then he took a cup, and after giving thanks, he gave it to them, saying, "Drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." Now, Luke has the blood of the covenant poured out for you. But Matthew, which is tailored especially to a Jewish audience, has poured out for many. The Greek for many was an inclusive idiom, actually. The Greek, in other words, does not connote some but not others. Why don't we just translate it all? Because many is an allusion, most likely, to Isaiah 53, which is the same mood as the Last Supper, in which a suffering servant bears the sins of many and will justify many. Justify, that means declare their innocence. The suffering servant of Isaiah 53 is an isolated figure, despised, shunned by men. We who do the shunning accounted him plagued, smitten, afflicted. So the Hebrew Bible is the first work of ancient literature to expose the dynamics of scapegoating. I'm very grateful to Emily for putting me on to René Girard some years ago. It was necessary to learn about scapegoat theory. This totally fits the immediate context of the Last Supper in Matthew, Luke, and Mark. The high priest Caiaphas at the time was appointed by Rome. Temple authorities, some of them, like Christian authorities, some of them today, were corrupted by alliance with godless rulers. Confronted with trumped-up charges against Jesus, Caiaphas is reported by John to have said, "It's better for one man to die than for the whole nation to perish." So in a sense, Jesus and Caiaphas were on the same page, but for different reasons. Jesus was, on behalf of God, willingly enacting the role of the scapegoat in hopes of being publicly vindicated by God as a stand-in for everyone through the ages who has suffered this indignity. Caiaphas wasn't wrong, right? He wasn't wrong. I mean, messianic movements were a threat to Rome, and that placed the whole nation in jeopardy. You know, the moral logic is to save the many at the cost of the few. I mean, who wouldn't make that calculation? Why not leave the, you know, what's the point of leaving the 99 and, you know, for the one if the 99 are going to be in trouble? But we also know that there is power to be gained by riling up the many against the few. And the few, doesn't matter who they are, could be anyone. Immigrants, great choice over the years. Anyone whose existence challenges the presumed advantage of the fragile, frightened majority. Even today, the wrong initials can be demonized. Are you picking up what I'm laying down? Okay. Jesus is enacting, in a sense, the scapegoat drama to reassure us the mob will not have the last word. God will repudiate the mob and exonerate the mob's targets. That's the message of the Last Supper in concert with 3 days later. To receive communion is to place our bets, to place our hopes on that reality, to make it our like sustaining dream through times of trouble. Think about rituals, though. Their meaning cannot be reduced to one theory or one explanation. If one explanation of a ritual sufficed, why would we need the ritual? Howard Stern asked Lady Gaga, what feelings fueled Perfect Celebrity, one of her latest songs, Perfect Celebrity. Yeah, I'm really down with Lady Gaga. You'd really be impressed at the hip things that I'm into. Lady Gaga said, "If I could put it into words for you, Howard, I wouldn't have put it into a song. That wisdom could have spared Europe a lot of holy wars, right, over the years. In rituals, meaning is enacted, not didacted. At best, we can identify a cluster of meanings. So a range of meanings are conveyed in ritual. So what are some of those grapes in the cluster, so to speak? Let's be cute with our metaphors. I'm up here, a pastor giving a sermon, after all. Well, it's a ritual, but I'm not going to name it grape number one, grape number two. I mean, thank God. I mean, I'm not that far gone. It's a covenant meal. A covenant binds parties to each other. God initiated this covenant. Whatever threats, you know, picture the disciples and Jesus in the Last Supper in the upper room, whatever threats or machinations are brewing out there, in here, we are held together by God. We are enfolded in the arms of God. And oh, it's a ritual meal. It's a ritual meal. What's happening at a meal? We're enacting the power of being together. In terms of the background to this meal, in the dark hours before the dawn, so to speak, like the original Passover meal and the Last Supper, there's a consolation that only comes with being together to draw sustenance together for a shared circumstance and burden. I have felt that a lot lately at church on Sunday. I wake up on Sunday morning, I need to get me to church today. I've been watching too much news lately. Yeah. The Last Supper, remember, it occurred decades. It occurred decades, you could even argue centuries, before there was an elaborate belief system that we call Christianity. Why were the disciples there, though? They were there because they had never known anyone like him. And that's reason enough for us to be here. The closest thing to a meaning statement provided by Jesus at the Last Supper was something they actually didn't want to hear and didn't understand. They received it before they understood what he meant by, "This is the blood of the covenant poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." I mean, how many scapegoating mobs are being generated right now on social media, like at this moment, like scapegoating flash mobs are happening all over the world. When we get caught up in this madness, we are the ones who need the forgiveness. That's the message of the meal, I think, tucked into that word, many. Betrayal is certainly a theme at the meal. But in a scapegoating event, betrayals are multiplied. It's never like one person who betrays you during a scapegoating event. Jesus knew, for example, that at the meal, he knew that Peter would betray him. He knew that the disciples would scatter. They were in a situation of very rapidly shifting dynamics in Jerusalem, and those dynamics were driven by the fear of Roman reprisal. All but John and the Marys, in fact, would scatter to save their own skins. Surely the forgiving Jesus felt these multiple betrayals more than anyone. I mean, betrayal is the worst relational injury you can suffer. It has to come by definition from a trusted one, only a trusted loved one can betray you. And only the closest loved ones can betray you in a way that really, really hurts. Scan the headlines. I mean, how many people are experiencing betrayal? I mean, food banks cut off from USDA funding. Oh, that's $1 billion a year. The destitute around the world cut off from essential American relief under the banner of what? Break it and then fix it? I mean, Psalm 80 has a line for what's happening now. It's boars of the forest ravage it. Maybe we are drawn to the suffering servant in this meal because Jesus would not. He was modeling something that we need when we're in the midst of a betrayal situation. He wouldn't let the betrayal embitter him. He didn't meet the cruelties of Rome with hate, but with this is the blood of the covenant poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. The power that defeats hate is non-retaliating love that looks like this Galilean in his time of testing at this meal. Maybe we want to affiliate him for another reason. Like us, he felt hounded and surrounded, but he was not at his core, he was not confounded. He had conviction. For times like these, we need a resilient faith that bends but doesn't break, and that requires, like the trunk on a tree, it requires a convictional core. I mean, conviction is not the same as certainty. No, conviction is an inner confidence in a few non-negotiables that are hoped for. Without conviction, what is to keep us from getting caught up in the social dynamics that are happening in our world today? What is to keep us from becoming permanently embittered by the social dynamics that we see happening every day and that are in our face all the time and that are affecting us or affecting our loved ones? This calm conviction of Jesus was born of faith. Faith, a conviction of something hoped for. Empowered, in his case, by a joy that was set before him, like a lifeline pulling him through troubled times. That's what joy does, you know, when we're in the midst of the, you know, it's the joy that if we grab hold of it, there's something on the other end of the joy pulling us through the troubled times. Have you noticed lately how these victory songs that we've been singing, I love the victory songs, you know? When I go to certain churches where the demographic is a certain thing and they're singing the battle is the Lord song, I'm like, oh, please. Because that has a whole different resonance. But lately we've been singing the battle belongs to the Lord and they're like, yes. Yes, facing seeming defeat, a good victory song, you know, is empowering. Thank you, Marcus and the band, for these songs lately. Don't forget, the meal ended with a hymn sing. Matthew and Mark both report this. When people sing together, it's been mentioned, heart rate synchronized, or try to figure out why it has something, AI says it's something to do with the vagus nerve and breathing, I don't know. But I feel it when it's happening. When like enough of us are singing together, the synchronizations happens. When we are in a group of people singing, even if our minds are jangled, our bodies know we're not alone. Why do a meditation when we can have communion? Let's, Emily, you want to just, are you leading the, who's leading the? But don't we do the candles first, right? Okay, let's get on with it. All right. Yeah.